He was an old man who fished alone in a skiff in the Gulf Stream, and he had gone 84 days without taking a fish. In the first 40 days, a boy had been with him, but after 40 days without fish, the boy's parents told him that the old man was now definitely and finally slow, which is the worst form of unlucky, and the boy had gone at their orders in another boat, which caught 3 good fish the first week. That is the opening few lines from The Old Man and the Sea by Ernest Hemingway. Hello, everyone. Kyle Tierman here. Hope you're all having a wonderful day from wherever you are listening to my voice. And we got a book club now. Every month, we read a short book, one that hovers right around 100 pages long, and we read it together. You can join the club by going to tierman.substack.com or just clicking the link below this podcast description. And just once a week, I will send a short email with a question prompting deeper thought into that book. This is a very selfish experiment, as there are many short classics that I have never read, and I'm guessing you haven't either. The kinds of books that you wish you would have read, but just needed that excuse to do so. The Old Man and the Sea is one of them. This is our second book. We just finished a book by John Steinbeck called The Pearl. Boy, that was a brain fart and a half. Yeah, we just finished The Pearl. It was such a memorable book, I forgot its name. It was actually an incredible book. And now we are on to The Old Man and the Sea. So if you get this message and you want to read along with us, go pick up The Old Man and the Sea from your local bookstore. Sign up for my newsletter at tierman.substack.com. And that's it. Also, this is a free podcast, and I rely on listeners like you to support it however you see fit. If that means free, then it's free. Just keep listening. Share it with a friend. Leave a review on iTunes. If you can contribute $6 a month, that is the paid subscription fee. It offers you some bonus content. It supports the show. And it's just a good thing to do if you like me blathering on out into the world. Tierman.substack.com. That's where it all happens. This episode is with a professional skier named Clayton Vila. I met Clayton a few weeks back. I had a barbecue, friend of a friend, thanks Kevin, and he was just an interesting cat with a varied history. He grew up on the tiny island of Block Island in Rhode Island, and set out to become a professional skier. And he found his stride in the world of street skiing. Check out some of this guy's YouTube stuff. It's insane. He and his friends will use these like winches. It's basically like a generator with a tow rope attached to it. Huck themselves 40 miles an hour going off jumps that they make themselves through cities. It looks like the most extreme version of snow parkour you've ever seen. And he's humble, he's cool, he's got a lot to say, and he doubles both as a professional skier as well as a director. He has done documentaries, branded content. He has directed documentaries that have appeared on ABC, Amazon Prime. He's legit, he's thoughtful. He's the greatest. Please give it up for Clayton Vila.
Kyle Tierman here. I'm in Cape Town.
I was the only journalist in northern Nigeria.
Not an adventure until you get lost in Tijuana.
You get caught inside by a giant wave, you feel really alone.
I love the adventure of waking up and not knowing what will happen and that being my job.
I'm standing at a desert oasis right now.
A lot of tourists don't see this part about Bali.
Smiles and thumbs up.
All right, Clayton Vila. Vila? Vila.
We'll go with Vila. Yeah.
We'll go to Vila.
That's my...
He's in the Vila.
Yeah.
You said something to me right when we first met that stuck with me about filming street skiing and the rising popularity of it. And you said, you know, a lot of it is just more interesting to film, which is why there's been a popularity in it. Like, you can light it really cool. The texture of streets and different features that we're skiing just look great from a filming perspective and from a photography perspective when compared to nothing but white on a half pipe or on the side of a mountain.
Yeah, that was... I do believe that's true. I mean, that's kind of a revelation I had later on as I started to kind of realize that I had a filmmaking mind and that I maybe wanted to be a filmmaker, you know? And it was something that actually somebody mentioned to me who was a filmmaker. They're like, yeah, some of the ski movies bore me because it's all just white. Right. And I was like, that never crossed my mind that color has had anything to do with this experience. And that kind of made me zoom out to, like, yeah, I mean, I'm sure you can understand it's just all about the tricks to us, right? And I mean, with the street skiing thing, it's video parts, quite literally, just like skateboarding, you know, like we're that's the craft, that's the art, is, you know. And to me, I always boil it down to just, like, what tricks am I doing, right? And the person who does the, not just better tricks, but, you know, has a balance of technical tricks and versus, you know, big tricks and small tricks to give the big ones proportion, you know, like all these kind of nuanced things that, you know, I've obsessed over to the point that it, you know, was, yeah, just those were the things that I thought and was correct to some extent would be the things to focus on to make the best video part ever. But then you start to realize, no, how I film these is of equal importance for sure. And that's when you start to be like, oh, how I craft this video part, like, and then the edit and then whatever. When you're doing it, you really realize how, you know, that there's 10,000 different versions of your video part if you do the exact same tricks, right? And that was kind of when I went, holy shit, I think I'm a filmmaker as much as I am a skier.
Right. And I would imagine that you're walking down the street and you're seeing, whether it be a handrail or a huge brick wall or something like that, and you almost have x-ray vision. Like, you're seeing a city from a completely different view than most people. Like, I'm guessing, linking things, like, oh, maybe I could do that handrail, or that I could link it with this wall right here. And you're sort of like building this this potential in your mind just in on a day when most people are just walking down the street and seeing it as nothing but a set of stairs.
Yeah, it's true. A little bit less so these days, which I'm proud of in a way, because it will almost drive you nuts, you know, because I'm sure, you know, your ability to identify that is because that's how your brain is with waves or, you know, anything that looks relatively like a wave, right? If you're sitting there, your mind surfing the wall, right? And I mean, especially when I was at the peak of what I was doing, I mean, you know, as you're talking, I'm wall riding that wall over there, you know, it's like, or you're constantly trying to find angles out of things that, you know, aren't built to serve that purpose. So there's that postmodern almost aspect to it that made it a bit more artistic, even though I don't really know if that word has any meaning anymore. But it's a certain form of creativity that it was, you know, it's very exciting. I mean, finding those spots is such a motherfucker, you know? I mean, we look at Google Maps, you know, in Finland of places, of a single spot we want to hit, and we'd fly there for it, you know what I mean? Get a shitty Motel 6 down the road from it, you know, like mainly just to get that one clip. And then when you get, once you get there, you start driving around and just looking and looking and looking and eating McDonald's, driving for 16 hours a day, just looking around a city, you know, Googling schools, parks, and different cities have different people who developed them. And there's different places that these handrails, wall rides or whatever will be, you know, some they're all in the Minnesota. It's like there's tons of these stair sets at schools. So it's like, go to schools on the weekend or late at night, bring lights or whatever. It's the name of the game. You know, you go up to Quebec and it's totally different. There's like a lot of, I don't know, there's just kind of shit everywhere because it's a lot older. It's built at a different time. So there's like these old structures and walls and things like that. And there's some cities that look, that amazing spot just doesn't work because, you know, people just aren't, the society is just like, we don't like this. Like, so they're up in arms. I mean, there's just so many weird aspects about it that makes it like a really intellectual kind of experience, like trying to figure out how the hell you're gonna, you know, you're ultimately just doing illegal shit too, and that's fun as hell a lot, you know what I mean? Because there's certain cities where we've gotten into and you're just feeling it out, you're like, how are people reacting, where are the spots, whatever. And there's been a couple times where you're just like, fuck it, we gotta go nocturnal for this one, you know. So you just, that next day you just are like, well, all right, we looked at all the spots we found, we have like 30 of them. If you're lucky, yeah, we had 30. I don't think that's ever really happened. You usually start with like 10, and then you find, as you're driving to that spot, you find another one, whatever, you know, you just let it go. And yeah, but then we'd just be like, all right, everyone go to sleep, because we're going to be up all night for the rest of this trip.
Where, and you're going to places where I'm guessing they have really high snowfall, so there's a certain amount of snow just on the ground where people are walking.
Generally, that's like a Quebec. Those are actually kind of, it's pretty rare that you have those. Quebec is definitely one of those places. Finland is one of those places that's the perfect, you know, architecture, development, whatever.
Plus there's a lot of snow.
Yeah, like Quebec's kind of like the LA for skiing and snowboarding street, that LA is for skateboarding, if you will, you know.
Do you think, is that the best place in the world to be a street skier?
I don't know. You know, now it's like, it's just, spots are not, the spots are rare. They're really, really, really rare, because you need an in-run and an out-run, and you need to be able to, and you need snow, you know, or you have a winch or a bungee to like give you speed. But like, even if you have that, you need like a lot, you know, snow is a lot more friction than skateboarding, than like just throwing down a skateboard on concrete, you know. And we're doing a lot bigger spots, we're going a lot faster. A lot of the time we need to go 40 miles an hour to hit like some of these bigger spots. And so like, even if it is flat and you have a winch that gets you that fast, it's just a weird thing. So what I'm trying to say is like, I don't, you know, I think it's gotten past, like, at least when I, you know, me and my group of friends, who we really were kind of the first people to take it really seriously, where we were making video parts that were only street, you know, and we were looking for, you know, not to just pepper a part that was, you know, your Alaska backcountry line's going to end the movie and you'd hit two handrails because you had nothing else to do in between those trips. There was no snow and, you know, the places you wanted to go heli or hit jumps or whatever. We were doing nothing but that. We always had to go all over the country at minimum if we had a good snow year, in the world. So, you know, a lot of the best places, it would just be a strike mission. It just like snows a couple feet and we've, you know, somewhere we've clocked, we're just like, we're there. So a lot of the time, you know, I lived in Colorado at the time, and our group of like 5 to 8 guys or whatever, maybe like 3 to, you know, minimal crew, you need like 4 people. I mean, you gotta have people to shovel. So, you know, we just see it snow in somewhere like Minnesota or Boston or whatever. And we, Calgary, there's places that are just like, you know, let's do that. You know, we already know spots we're going to hit. But there's times where it'd just be like, yo, it just snowed 3 feet in this weird ass place. Should we just go? Like, and we're like, you know, all right, let's drive there. And you have to drive because you have your winches and like all that shit. Unless you fly.
So for people who don't know what a winch is,
A winch is like, we have these high speed winches that are, basically just like a motorcycle engine, where instead of a wheel, there's a rope wrapped around it. And the winch we use, which was a good one, as this guy who, you know, makes them out of his garage, Kurt Heine. And yeah, there's literally a motorcycle throttle, and you pull the line out and your homie hangs onto it and you hit the throttle for him and you just pull him in.
Fuck!
It's a super gnarly thing because, I mean, you have to throw it at the right time and it fucking runs into you a lot of the time. Like, it'll, so we have this, like, you know, you'll build a snow guard. We have, like, you know, a guard that it'll run into and shit. So the whole thing's, we did car tows and shit like that before that. But yeah, it's when you're running the winch for your buddy, it's, that's a whole nother thing too. I mean, it's, you got to trust your winch strap. I mean, you're looking at, like, you know, we don't have a speedometer, right. You know what I'm saying? So they're kind of like, you can throw it early or right. You can cut speed or whatever. But a lot of time we're in really narrow corridors, you know?
Right. So, it's like towing a surfer in on a jet ski. Like the jet ski driver has a ton of responsibility
right.
to be able to throttle it and get you in with the right amount of speed right where the surfer wants to hit the wave.
It's an, it's probably, a very similar relationship that you have where it's like your turn, my turn, right? And don't fuck around when it's your turn. You know, you're almost more focused with the winch because, you know, something about, right, when you're in the pocket and you're full of adrenaline and you're doing a trick, you're, you know, you're less worried about your own life.
Yeah,
than when you're, you know, running the winch for your homie. And, you know, the other thing is they'll give it a speed, you know, how you speed check jumps, whether it's backcountry jump, park jump, or a street wall ride jump, rail, or whatever, something you got a gap and gauge speed on. You slide up the takeoff and take a look and kind of just, like, look at your buddy who's right next to it and, like, did I have the speed? And you're like, yeah. And, you know, they're like, all right. You know, obviously, it's understood. It's your responsibility. It's the person hitting it. But
right.
Yeah.
So let's say there's you've built a little snowpack jump, and I'm gonna get a lot of the snow terminology wrong.
Paraphrase.
Because,
I don't
yeah,
care.
I'm yeah. a I'm a fair weather snowboarder at best. But let's say there's a little jump that you and your buddies have built that kicks you over. I mean, I saw some of the videos of you. It's fucking insane, man. Yeah. Like you're jumping. You know, going over a rail, down two stories. I mean, it's like the equivalent of the most extreme parkour you've ever seen, plus ski and snow. But so you'll get a winch and you'll approach one of these jumps, maybe going 40, and then right before you'll speed check it to ensure
hit
that
the brakes. Yeah.
You'll hit the brakes to be like, okay, did it feel like I could clear that next railing?
Exactly.
You know, 15 feet away and then make the landing where I want it. So you're constantly, I mean, I would imagine that you have gotten so good at gauging where speed will take you.
Mm.
Like you're, this is how fast I need to go. And even though I haven't hit this jump, I'm guessing that I'm going to land at it right there. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of it's the build, like most, you know, going back to how street is such like a, the skiing part is such a little aspect of it. Like it really is. And the build is, you know, paramount, right? So like you put, you know, all right, I'm going to jump where, right? Like even if you're literally like, this is the end of the building, I'm jumping off the building. Some of the more like easily digestible, you know, things in terms of how you approach
yeah.
them.
Yeah. Let's give someone an example.
Okay.
Like, yeah.
Yeah,
someone into
sure.
a hole.
So like, you know, a gap to rail, like, you know, you jump over a fence and you land on a rail that, you know, has a downward slope and you grind the rail just like a skateboard does. And then you land. Right. So it's like, you know, all right, there's a fence between where I'm going to build the jump and the rail. Right. Do I build it 4 feet back, 6 feet back? Do I build it 6 feet back a little flatter, or do I build it 3 feet back, poppier, right? Like, do I build it like 4 feet high or just like 2 feet high, you know? And sometimes the thing that makes you more nervous is actually the better solution, mm-hmm. right? Like where, you know, you want a higher jump because you don't want to catch a fence, but if you build a lower one, you can see more what's going on, so you can spot, you know, where you're going to be. So there's all these nuanced decisions. And yeah, I mean, yeah, ultimately, whatever you choose, yeah, you have to decide, you know, eventually you do all these speed checks and they're not for nothing, but it's not much, you know. Eventually you pull the trigger, and when you pull the trigger, that's more what it's all about. It's that first go. And That's where you're just kind of, you know, it's a lot like the experience of surfing when it's just like, yeah, this is a wave, but like, I, you know what I mean? It's going to be different every time, you know, and throughout your session, if you're going a little fast, you might not realize till it's too late, and you can absorb, you know, you can carve, you can, you know, do things to create a different trajectory. And, yeah, that's the name of the game, really.
How often do you feel scared before you're hitting jumps that make it into edits?
I'm a very nervous person. When it comes to skiing. So, I always have been, and I've just always been very careful. So I've never felt, I'm always confident going into something, you know, but confidence is earned.
Right. And do you feel like you have friends that just don't have the fear part of their brain for whatever reason turned on?
Yeah, they didn't, they got hurt, right. You know?
And I feel like that's the case with a lot of sports where you see someone doing extreme shit. The way that I see it, you know, what you're doing is, it's so foreign to me. Right, like I grew up skating. I would hit some handrails, mostly half pipe stuff, mm-hmm. but just the velocity that you're going and the, you know, being on skis is like I just don't fucking understand it. But I feel like two outsiders most of the time you're like, oh, these people are just crazy. They have a screw loose and they don't get scared. But I agree with you that the people who do really have screws loose, you don't make it very far.
Yeah.
End up getting catastrophically injured.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just not, I think that the successful professional athletes, especially in action sports, are the ones who are very scared, but are willing to face it, you know, and put in the work to suppress that lucky part of them that is so afraid, you know? I mean, when I was younger and I first like decided I want to be a pro skier, I mean, big jumps scared the living shit out of me, but you know, I just really, really wanted it. So, you know, I faced it, and yeah, I think that's when you see people getting to a level where they've earned their confidence.
I like what you just said, that the lucky part of you that's scared. I really like the way that you put that, because so often we think like, oh, the part of me that's scared, you don't want that. Like, I just want to feel confident. And to actually reserve some respect for that part of yourself and even gratitude is wise.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah. I mean, I said earlier, confidence is earned. And I think like, you know, going back to it, I've seen a lot of people where, close friends of mine, you know, I had one friend who was just so talented, you know, and he had times where he would be in the pocket, you know, and he was unbelievable, you know, like, because that fearlessness does, you know, some people who can access that, you know, can go to some crazy levels, you know. But to me, it's always about like, you know, all right, your bar is here, like knowing that there's a bar that is your comfort level, right? Like as far as you can go, not your comfort level, I should say. It's just literally beyond this, I'm taking risks that are not, you know, legitimately, they're not logical, right? They're just, it's reckless. And getting like right next to that bar, like just a millimeter under it, you know, that is the pocket, you know, but just always keeping an eye on it and not forgetting about that, you know. And I would watch him, and there'd be so many times where I would just see that look in his eye and I'd be like, dude, like stop, you know, like you're completely hypnotized by your adrenaline right now, you know, like. And it's tough, I think, because, you know, I'm sure you know what it's like to get in the pocket like that. And you want to keep that adrenaline up, but you have to be brave enough to shut it down and let yourself be afraid and aware, you know, at the same time.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, it is. you do get hypnotized by adrenaline. And I think that, I think it's really healthy, you know, being in a state of adrenaline and learning to become literate in the language of adrenaline, right, and be able to stay calm in moments like that. Because most people just don't have the experience of seeking out adrenaline. And the more time you spend in any given mental state, the more you grow to understand it.
Mm.
For me, in the experiences that I've had surfing in big waves, I feel it's like it's a lot of catching waves and like catching energetic waves. Like there could be a session, you know, a lot of big wave sessions are out for 5 or 6 hours. You know, those, it's an all day thing. And you're not going to be feeling great the whole time. A lot of times you could wake up and feel like total shit and not want to go out there. But then you just decide to go out, see how you're feeling. Then you catch a wave, like an energetic wave of like, ooh, I actually want to do this. Like I felt a little bit of energy here. Like, ooh, I want to do this right now. And then you, okay, I'm on the wave. It's time right now to like, this is the time to go. I'm feeling warm. I feel like my body's working really well. I mean, that's, I don't know how much it is skiing, but like, dude, if you're going in the middle of the night in Quebec, I'm sure it's like negative 20.
Yeah, you don't want to do it. You don't want to do shit.
Right? So yeah. I think same with temperature is an overlooked aspect of the whole thing. Like if you're out surfing in cold water and you're on your fourth or fifth hour, and
or a cloudy day surfing, right, makes you just nervous as hell, right? For whatever, you know, it's just the energy.
Totally. So you can start to cramp up, your body can start to not feel great. And I really, as much as possible now, I try and recognize like, okay, I'm catching a wave right now, and now is the time that if a wave comes, I really want to go.
Yeah, yeah.
And then once you, and then not to get greedy, you know, like after a few, if you're feeling really high on adrenaline, but
right, if that gets you up, then don't get too, you know, don't think that it's, you know, now you're God all of a sudden.
Totally.
Right?
Yeah. So you're playing with something, and then to realize, you know, okay, that was a really good one. I haven't had any bad wipeouts today. I'm going to call it a day and take that as being, you know, one of the best days of my year.
Yeah. You touch the bar, you know, right? Like don't get carried away. No, I think you're right. And so I think that that's like, you know, I mean, another word that probably has no meaning now, but it's just like being present, you know, but you know, if you actually try to actualize that, it's like, you know, a lot of the times when you're expecting it to be the best day is the most, I hate that. You know?
Totally, like, that's not good.
You know, right? And so, yeah, you find magic when you're, you just got to deal with whatever you're working with, you know, low highs, high lows, right? You know, and just that makes, that's what does make you present, you know, I think. And just those are the days that you look back on. And, you know, if you're trying to emulate a day that you previously had, it doesn't work, right? When the magic happens is when you're there and you're just doing what it is and see what happens. And sometimes it makes something beautiful and sometimes it doesn't, but you know, you gotta be able to
handle
it. And
it's so mysterious and ephemeral. Like you can have a shitty night of sleep and have the best day of your life.
Right.
And then all of a sudden it's horrible.
When I was younger, I used to like always be trying to like do the thing, like in competition and shit, you know, you'd like something would happen and I'd be like, do that again. It might be some weird shit. I'd be like, I got high and I was like concussed 2 days ago.
Yeah.
And like, you know what I mean? You're like almost like trying to do it, you know? And it's like, no, dude, like,
just hit me.
It's because ironically you weren't doing that.
Yeah.
You know, that you were, you know, not thinking that you were in this perfect state. You were just letting it happen. That
did you if you were going to hit something big and you knew that the stakes were high, did you have any kind of mantra or ritual or routine of any kind?
No. Well, no, you just kind of become the, you just, I don't know. I think you end up eventually having habits, but I mean, it was so spontaneous. And that was, I think, why I did a lot better with it than competition. Like, I had a run with half pipe competition that I was good at for sure. And like, I was on an early draft for the first Olympic team when I was younger, and you know, my family's all into that idea, you know, obviously. And I couldn't handle that. I don't know. And I think it was because of that. I mean, I love pressure, you know, oddly. You put a camera on me and I'm going to like perform, oddly, for some reason, because I see that as like nothing but a good opportunity, right? Yeah. But like, I don't know. I would win practice is a thing that we would say, and, you know, and then blow it on the day because, you know, you got that run. How do I do that run again instead of like, you know, this is something different right now. It's when you're looking at a regulation half pipe and it's like, do the run that you do over and over again. Not like do that run, but it's going to be different today, and it should be, right? That's something that I didn't get. I think I was just young and I wasn't like working on it a lot, but you know, getting back to your question, it's like the spontaneity of street is what I love so much. And no matter what you're doing, you had no fucking clue what you're supposed to do. It's a new spot. I mean, every rail you hit, everything, you know, different in run, different city, different everything, you know, every single thing you do, you have to just use your intuition. And so the answer is no, you know. I mean, literally sometimes we'd just be like driving home after hitting a spot at 2 a.m. and you'd see a spot and you're like, dude, let's do this right now. We could get away with this right now. And like, you just do it, you know. And that shit's, next thing you know, you're like, you literally smoked a joint and you're like, we're done for the night. And then you see a spot and you're like, oh shit, I'm doing this right now. And next thing you know, you're at the top of this thing like, what am I getting myself into?
That's,
you know?
So fun. I've had the same thing. Like sometimes out at Mavericks, you'll take a boat out there so you can have all day and you're not in the water. And I've had a one particular day, we were surfing all day, so fun. Finished up, still in the wetsuit. People are pouring Jack Daniels shots. Yeah. Take a couple shots. Right.
We are wrapped.
Epic day. We are wrapped. And you're like, damn, still pretty good out there.
Yeah.
Dude, I'm doing it out for one more.
I love that moment right there, though, when you're like, am I doing this?
Or? We had that. I had a great one of those this summer.
Because it makes that fear where you're like, this is literally the last decision I ever made in my life.
Totally.
You know what I mean? Right? Like, because you, yeah, I don't know. Whatever.
It's the best, though. I did a really fun boat trip this last year to the Mentawai Islands with a group of close friends. And Mentawai Islands are in Indonesia, just some of the best waves in the world. A lot of really shallow, rifling, barreling waves, you know, over crystal clear coral reefs. And there's this wave called the Rags Right. Really shallow, really good. We rocked up and it was an all-day tube fest. Like 2 to 3 barrels on every wave going as fast as you can. So sick.
Yeah.
And we finished up the day. Someone had brought mushrooms on the trip. So everyone's getting high on mushrooms. I'm like, all right, let's do this. We like take a couple mushrooms. I'm like, well, look at these psychedelic perfect waves come through. There's like 30 or 40 minutes before dark. Everyone's gone in. And I'm just like, I think I need to go back out there.
Yeah, am I really not going to surf these waves? What else am I doing here?
78 degree water or something like that.
Right.
And I freaking just paddled back out. And I was like, you know, everything like slows down and feels very vibrant. And you like start having these things, these thoughts like, I'm paddling through water right now.
Right. Well, dude, new perspective, right? It changes everything.
Like, what is water?
Dude,
whoa.
I actually used to do that with one of my good buddies and I, who I like learned how to do a lot of the like park skiing part of things, which is kind of the training for the, you know, training area of skiing that led to street ultimately. And like, we're at the stage where, you know, there's no airbags or like that kind of shit. So we're in the stage of skiing where double flips were just starting to happen. So we're like, we got to learn double flips. And there's no way to flip twice on a trick than just fucking doing it. it's a wild, like, you know, ladder step. Like, there's 10 of the ladder steps missing, and you just have to, like, try it. You know what I mean? Like, there's no way to warm up to it. So it was this like really crazy part of life when we were learning these double flips. And, you know, we're like, we got to get these figured out because this is the future and whatever. And they're scary as fuck. And like, you don't want to do too many of them and like whatever. And they're, so you just.
So these are double backflips.
Basically, yeah. So like, you know, a there's like in skiing, there'll be like a, if you do like a 1080, you know, there's like different axes to do 1080s. So there's like a cork 1080 or like a bio 1080. And it basically is how you, the direction in which you flip like a cork 10 is like when you're flipping backwards while spinning a 1080, like a bio is when you're moving forward, whatever. There's tons of variations of like the way you spin and whatever. But a double means that you, you know, do two flips while you're spinning, right? So a double cork 1080 is basically like a off axis double backflip 1080, right? But like, you know, you've done forever, you do these, you know, cork 1080s, and then it's like at some point you literally chuck it two times as hard, halfway through it you spot and you go, I'm gonna do it again, you know. And it's like, you don't know if you're gonna do 1.5 or 2.5, like, and land directly on your head, you know. You just kind of have nothing but intuition, so you got to go for it. But the reason that I brought it up was that me and my buddy were trying to get them on lock, and you don't want to do them too much. So at the end of the day, we'd be like, fuck, how are we going to, like, you know that we're going to be able to put these down at this competition, like, next week? And I was, we were both like, dude, we should just, like, do them and then get really high in the woods and then do them again. And, like, if we can, like, be blasted and do these, like, we're probably going to be able to handle any kind of circumstances that, like, that we have to deal with in this competition. And we, like, it's just like this dumb, like, 18, so like, I think like that was about the age it was, 17, 18. I mean, no, I mean, it worked those days. Like, we didn't get hurt, you know, or whatever. And it was fun as hell. But I'll tell you what, like, that there is some truth to, like, I don't know. I used to ski high all the time, and I would be, whether it was that situation or another, I would be skiing all day and you're tired and skiing for 8 hours, and the same thing would happen. And you're like, we're done, let's go smoke the last joint in the woods. And then you get like really high, and all of a sudden I think I'm like in the X Games and I have some trick idea in my mind. I'm like, I'm fucking doing that, you know. It's just a new perspective. And I actually utilize that with my like writing and creative stuff these days too a lot. Like,
you'll smoke weed and
not like, you know, I don't get high the whole day. Like, yeah. I just live my life high like I used to, you know. I mean,
before we get, I want to ask you about writing and substances to write. Correct me if I'm wrong, but surfers get the stereotype of stoners. But I feel like skiers and snowboarders are way bigger stoners.
Oh, completely. Yeah.
Like getting high in mountain community is like, it feels like a way bigger. Don't get me wrong, there are stoners who surf.
Well, you
but
can't,
like,
smoke a joint in the ocean is the difference. We smoke weed on the chairlift every single time you go up the chairlift. You know, like, I mean, well, I don't anymore. Like, I used to be that, like, that kind of stoner.
I've always felt like that. Like, skiers and snowboarders are just always high.
Yeah. Oh, and then, I mean, trust me, there's not, I mean, it's probably similar with surfing in a lot of places that you're, you know, surfing 24/7, like a mountain town, we'd be skiing 24/7. But I mean, after you're done at 4 at the latest, you know, you're like, what are we doing? You know, right. And you continue to smoke weed. I mean, yeah, you smoke like friggin' 15 joints a day, you know, it's ridiculous. Right. But
there's also, it seems like, I want you to speak to this a little bit. It seems like there's this real clear delineation between elite ski culture and ski bum culture. Like, two different, like, when I think of you know, skiing and snowboarding, like, you go to Squaw Valley or something like that, and it's boku bucks to get on the chairlift, and it's a lot of very wealthy people. But there then is also this subculture of people who are just, like, grinding, figuring out what they can do to get on the mountain. And it's like, it seems like a whole, just community of people who are just like down to freaking sleep in the laundry room and like make it work however they can.
Yeah, there's definitely, you know, a huge class difference in, you know, on a ski mountain, obviously. Like, the ski mountain makes money off the rich families and whatever. And I mean, it's such a goofy sport like that where, you know, it's like, I think just going on skis down a mountain is the most exciting thing the average person has access to doing because of a chairlift and like, because there's like, you know, all this infrastructure that allows them to do something relatively extreme, you know. Second most extreme thing I've probably ever done is driving a car 65 miles an hour. You know what I mean? So, you know, it's like exciting to them, right? And whatever. So there's that whole thing. But yeah, I mean, yeah, then there's ski. I mean, totally ski bums. But I mean, pro skiers are the like epitome of ski bums that are, you know, I think that's probably like your ski bum in the 70s is just, you know, you're kind of pro today. I mean, you know, I say that with, take it with a grain of salt. There's obviously, you know, same with surfing and whatever. There's a level to this where there's certain people who, you know, obviously act like the same way an NFL football player would be, you know. But what I'm saying is, like, the 18-year-olds who are like are sponsored and get free skis and free gear. Like, that's the stage that we were at, you know, like. You're making just enough money off your sponsors that, you know, everything's paid for, you know, and you can pay your rent and buy weed and groceries, kind of.
Right.
And you're like, that creates a bum, right. You know, and it's like, yeah, it's
so,
a funny
group. So give me a quick background into where you grew up and then you moved to Boulder. So you didn't really grow up groomed or destined to be a pro skier at all. And I read that article where you said, you told your parents, I'm going to be a pro something. You're like, I don't know what it's going to be, but you're watching Shaun White videos and you're like, I'm going to become a professional something. So just give me the cliff notes of that background because it's super interesting.
Yeah. I grew up on Block Island, Rhode Island, which is like this island 15 miles or 14 miles, I think it actually is, off the coast of Rhode Island, and our boat ride, very remote place. There's 900 year-round residents. I had graduated with 8 kids, I'm pretty sure, in my grade. There's 140 kids kindergarten through 12th grade in the school. God. Like, the grade above me had, I think, graduated with 3 or 4 people, you know? So it's like, yeah. Small place, no mountains is the key point that I'm getting at. Good waves. I like skateboarding. I like surfing. You know, I was just like the action sports kid with a couple of my buddies who, you know, we got our winter suits when we were young and, you know, that was our life. And we skated when there wasn't waves. And I mean, outside of that, though, I've just always been an athlete. Like, that's just what I knew I was. You know, pick first in gym class. I mean, out of 8, you know. Well, it was more like out of, like, 28 because all the grades would do gym together.
Right,
so anyway, I was pretty good.
Soccer. World class.
In my co-ed soccer games. But you know what I mean. I just, yeah, whatever. Yeah, there's a certain person who fancies himself an athlete, and that's what their skills are, and that was me. And yeah, I had a TV with a few channels and the X Games were part of it, you know, and I'd freak the fuck out when I would see that. And a couple of times, you know, I went off island and was, you know, got some surf movies, you know, and yeah, I had, you know, some of the old Volcom movies, and I remember Creepy Fingers was one of the ones.
Yes, Creepy Fingers.
Yeah, so immediately, it's so funny how limited your exposure was. So it's just like whoever was the guy, you know, I like remember the day where I looked at all of like the videos and just picked that one, you know. Yeah. And now I'm a Bruce Irons fan.
Totally.
You
know,
if I picked another, it doesn't matter. Like, I would have been the biggest fan of whoever's in the video I picked, you know, if someone mailed me a different one, right?
Totally, man.
But lucky me, you know what I mean? But so same with, like, I ended up with a ski movie, you know, a couple ski movies. And to be honest, I was like, the sport's like, it's kind of cool, but, you know.
Surfing was the thing.
Yeah, I didn't really give a shit about it, to be honest. Like, but my dad would take us skiing on a trip to Colorado just about once a year because he loved skiing. And, like, he's a good recreational skier. And, you know, he'd take me to Double Black Diamonds and all that shit. And I loved it. I would just, you know, I would have a week to ski and I would kick ass as hard as I could, you know. And I'd love, like, you know, any athlete like that is, I think, like, you know, we're show offs, right? So I'd like be ripping when I'm fucking five and everyone's cheering for the lift. Like, I guess going for it, double ejecting in Mogul Fields, like just sending it, you know? So I had fun with it, but I never was destined to be a pro skier. But like, as I started getting, you know, a little older and seeing like, people like Sean Whites and, you know, just seeing that the, you know, how young people were starting to, progress, like people who are my age, right, going pro. I was like,
he was really young, right? He made it into the spotlight and was pretty famous by the time he was like 12.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I don't think that was like some, I don't know, he's mentioned a couple times, but like, it wasn't like he was, or anybody was a huge inspiration to me, really, like in particular, because I was so sheltered. I wasn't right. around anything, you know what I mean? But I had enough exposure to it to know that there was young kids doing things that, like, I was like, fuck, I got to do this, you know? Like, I think I have to do this now. And I was just one of those people that, like, the more I grew up, I just, you know, felt really confined by the, you know, island. Mm-hmm. You know, I was just like, yo, I got to do something. Like, I feel like I have some talent in this shit, and, like, I really want to give it a shot. And, you know, my parents were super supportive of the idea of that. And they, you know, they definitely saw that I had skills in sports. And they were like, we don't know anything about surfing, you know, and you're not, that's not going to happen here. Like, and skateboarding certainly isn't it. Like, we don't know anything about these sports, you know. But my dad was like, I can identify that you're a good skier. You know, I don't know what a good skateboarder or surfer looks like, right? Like, maybe you're, you know, the same level at all of them, but that one I know. And they had met someone kind of recently in New Hampshire where there was a program, and it's called Waterville Valley Academy. And it was mainly for people who went there for like full run of show as like a tutored, like, you know, not a prep school, but you'd stay in your home curriculum, and, you know, you would have tutors from like the community college down the street, you know, help you through your work while you got to ski for the second half of the day. And I did that for 1 month when I was 13, and like two, I think the most I did was 3 months. I did that through high school. So they put me into that. And so I would just go up there and fucking get it as hard as I could, you know? And I think I had an edge a little bit because I was there for a reason, for less time than everybody.
You're hungry.
And I was behind.
Right.
And I was hungry, you know? But when I first went there, I honestly, the first time I went, I was like, I don't want to do this. I mean, number one, leaving the island was the scariest thing I've ever done in my life.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, most of my friends are still there because I think a lot of them are just people who are like, this is it for me. And like, I love this. And I love the beauty of that kind of person, you know? I mean, that's who my parents are, and they're right. Like, this is the right place for them, you know? But how are you going to know unless you go somewhere else? Right. So I thought that my first experience doing that was just perspective and like that I didn't want to do that shit because I basically humiliated myself. I was so, you know, out of my element and like, you know, as far as everyone is concerned, I look like an idiot and my skis were the wrong size and, you know, whatever. I just basically like went up there and got concussions and came back and was like, I miss my friends, you know, and
right.
Like, I don't know if I want to do that, but after, you know, a little bit of time thinking about it, after I got home, I was like, no, I got to really do this. So I went back and, you know, I took me a while to get, I didn't really think it was working, to be honest, but the last like year I just clicked and like, I just started to figure out how to take off a jump well. And
how old were you at that point?
That's when I was like 16 or 17.
Okay. Do you feel like that was the year that you progressed most?
Yeah. I just had like a month period where I learned like every trick, you know, and it was just all the work before that of just like fucking not understanding, like just wow. Not getting it. Like, I don't know. I mean, kind of little hints of like figuring out, but there's just, I'm sure you can attest to this with surfing or whatever, but there's something where you're like, oh my God, there is some singular conceptual thing that you need to like crack.
Right.
And it's like, now in skiing, honestly, what it is once you can figure out how to take off of a jump, like, and be patient, and get into the air with like a legitimate amount of power to your spin, whatever trick that is, then you can land no matter what happens, really. You can, like, you know, there, you, like, it's, you get this, once you figure out how to get yourself in the air and figure it out, you know, and you get confident that you're going to figure it out, then it just takes, like, a lot of deep thought and intuition to just try some new shit. And once you can start to, like, then you basically feel like you have a blank canvas, and that's, you know, you can start to play, you know, you're not every time like, all right, like, this trick, I do this, this trick, I do this. You're just like, no, the trick is just a trick. And like, I'm going to, yeah, I got an idea and I'm going to try it. And you legitimately feel like, you know, you're like, oh, I want to draw something. Now I get to draw it. You know, it becomes so simple. And
that's a really cool insight that you, and I do think that learning happens that way. I felt that. I was a pretty serious skateboarder growing up. I wanted to be a pro skater.
I mean, you said you hit a couple handrails. That's no joke.
Yeah. Like, I mean, like, it was...
If you've even board slid a proper handrail, like, I mean, you know how...
Yeah,
you know, you can get as bodied hitting a 6-set handrail as you can hitting a 40-set rail on skis. Let's put it that way.
Why do you think that is?
There's no snow. Just straight concrete, you know?
Yeah, good point. I was mostly into half pipes, but I was really into half pipes. And,
damn,
you know, my...
Like proper, like 12-foot vert? Like, did you...
We were mostly, like, I would probably max out. I could skate vert ramps, but I was way better at, like... Put me on like a 6 to 8 foot mini ramp.
Yeah.
Like big enough that you can still do big.
You were working
shit.
Towards the idea of like trying to be a vert skater.
Yeah.
That's like what was in your mind.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool.
And Santa Cruz had a ton of sick ramps around, like, you know, 6 to 8 foot ramps, real wide, good transition. And I just grew up skating that way before I started surfing. Was into skating, and I've never thought of it, but to your point of you're frustrated, and then something conceptual clicks, and all of a sudden you can do like 8 new tricks.
Yeah, it's usually like getting the fuck out of your own way with like overthought, you know? I mean, you need all that overthought to get to that place, yeah, in a weird way, right? But like, there's some letting go that happens.
Totally.
You know?
Yeah. I think, I mean, I probably peaked as a skateboarder at like 16, because then after that, I just started breaking my arms and getting really into surfing, and was like, okay, I think I'm going to, you know, like, I got into surfing when I was 11, got into skating when I was like 8 or 9, and then did both, you know, a lot. Until, yeah, probably like I was 17.
Yeah.
Skating, and then skating, I was still skating through my mid-20s, just doing like, we had a mini ramp in our backyard and that kind of thing, but very much started to throttle it back,
yeah,
once I was getting more into surfing and realizing like, okay, I actually can't go for it super hard here if I also don't want to constantly be either like legitimately injured or just have a permanent bruised hip.
Yeah, no, I had the exact same experience. Yeah, I started skating when I was, yeah, little, and then,
but
so,
it's,
I mean,
so
you
fun.
you can't go like surfing legitimately when you're 3. You can get on a skateboard, right?
Totally.
And yeah,
but it's so fun. I still miss, I miss skating so much, just because,
me too,
it's such a fun sport.
Me too.
Oh my god.
I only throttled it back like a few years ago, just because, yeah, now that when I moved to LA, I kind of stopped skateboarding. Just cause I can surf all the time now.
Right.
I used to skate in the off season when I was skiing, but, that's just, yeah, skateboarding and skiing are pretty much the two things you can fuck yourself up the most with. So
totally.
I was kind of like, yeah, going back to surfing, remembering that like getting barreled is just an amount of thrill that I need.
Right.
And, it's kind of my good substitute.
Have you made it? I want to ask you about filmmaking and writing and this whole kind of next chapter that you're moving into. But before I did, were you able to make it through your career relatively injury free?
No. Once I was a legitimate professional, I rarely ever got hurt. But in the trial period, I got fucked up like all the time.
So before you, earlier, like before you kind of, you think that like you got, you maybe learned how to fall later?
But I mean, you always know how to fall, but it's just like before it clicked, you know, like we were talking about, like it's, like, you know, you want to try, you know, like I said, there's these different axes and shit that you don't, you know, you kind of need them all. You need to know how to, you know, in layman's terms, like spin and flip forward, spin and flip backwards, spin and flip to the side, you know, but they're all such different takeoffs and things, you know. So when you're going to try one for the first time, you're like, I think I understand it, but you don't. And then what happens? You hit a 50-foot jump and, you know, on the East Coast, you like lose yourself in the air and you go like, I don't know where I am in the air. And then you just wait until you hit the ground.
Fuck.
And you just get knocked the fuck out, you know? And it's like, I got knocked out a lot, for sure. The first handrail I ever hit, actually, I ripped this whole side of my face off, on the right.
How old were you?
I mean, that's a little dramatized way to put it, side of my face. My cheek right here got pulled off so you could, like, see my molars. And it was cheese grater stairs. Like, you know, the kind of, like, diamond serrated stairs that are often at ski mountains. So snow falls through them. They're legitimately sharpened, like, knives, you know, for people's ski boots, essentially. And, yeah, I went to my face on one of those. And
how old were you?
16. I woke up in the hospital, like, just with someone stitching me. I had a plastic surgeon, like, you know, figure it out because it was so, you know, messy. Whoa. But, so that was.
Did that deter you at all?
I mean, no, it's kind of a good time to get, like, I mean, like I said, I got knocked out cold. I'm getting knocked out cold. It's the shittiest thing, like, that you could ever get, like, you know. It's the biggest reality check for that sport where it's like, you know, you do that a couple of times, you know, like, do I want to keep doing this? You know, it's scary. Yeah. You know, sometimes.
Are you ever wearing a helmet?
I did it through the whole trial period. Once I went pro, I stopped wearing a helmet, never got a concussion again.
Why?
Why did I stop wearing a helmet?
Yeah.
This is an art, you know, I really believe in that. And that's just part of the art form. Like it is a show and it makes a big difference. You know, when I was competing, I'd always wear a helmet because whatever, you're trying to like land the run. But like I said, making a video part is not just quantifiable. It's not just a series of tricks, you know, like this is an art form and it's a major aspect about, you know, what you want things to look like. And there's an undeniable amount of character that you feel when there's an individual who's doing something with that level of commitment. And I really was attracted to that and wanted it to be a part of my art form, you know? Mm. And there's probably an aspect that makes you take everything you do a little bit more seriously, to be honest. But also, but that's also, that's like, I've heard a lot of dumb people, frankly, say like, oh, never wear a helmet because then you're just not, you know, then you just think you're protected. It's like, that's
right. You're not going to go head first. That's stupid.
That's stupid. I think it's just more like when you get to the level of the shit that we were doing, especially with street or whatever, a helmet is such a minor part of what's going to give you a concussion. There's actually a lot of times where I would have knocked myself out if I had a helmet on because, for example, like we're just never running in headfirst to a railing or a wall. Like that's not in the cards. You know, if that's in the cards, don't do it. You know, you're just not hitting that spot straight up, like move on to another spot, you know, like, you know, it's that simple. And like I said, these builds are really important. You know, we like with the way we build things, like we would shovel so much snow, you know, alongside of a railing.
So that if you're falling off, you're falling into snow.
Yeah. When you put, you know, it takes, you know, 10 hours sometimes. I mean, it takes days sometimes to set up these spots, you know, and like four of those hours you'll spend, you know, building a helmet on the ground. Right. And just so you know, if you land head first in that big soft pile of snow with a hat on, your head's hitting a soft pile of snow. If you have a big, hard 10-pound thing on your 10-pound head, you might as well put it down there instead of put it on and run your head into it straight up.
Wow.
So, you know, I'm not saying that that's like objectively true for every situation or everybody or whatever. But yeah, like I said, I didn't get any concussions doing the street thing. It's after I ripped my face off. That right. is. I had a helmet on when I did that. So, you know, that's what I'm saying. It's got nothing to do with it. You know, it really doesn't. But I will admit that I think it's just a part of the way that I, you know, I'm a character in these little movies.
Right.
really, you know? And when you're doing gnarly shit, it's just, I don't know. I just also like that shit. I love that it's a part of skateboarding. I like the culture part of it. I like that, you know, it's illegitimate in skateboarding unless you have a helmet on. It's like, why? It's like, because fuck you. I don't you know. It's cool. Like, straight up, you know? So, yeah.
As a surfer, I tip my wet head at you because we fall into water.
Yeah. Well, sure, people are nice. Wearing helmets a lot now surfing. And like I've heard him mention that, like, you know, it's like, yo, it's tough in a barrel. You're going to get clipped with that little extra bit of shit on your head. And now what? Now you're going to the bottom of the reef. I don't know. I thought that was an interesting, you know, thing that I wouldn't know about because I'm usually not that deep in the barrel where I'm navigating inches or millimeters or I'm not that good at it. So where I'm not paying attention to it, but you know.
Yeah. Yeah. The cool factor is definitely shifted in surfing because helmets were seen as really goofy in surfing for a long time, and then enough people hit their head on the reef at Pipeline that now you have more of the cool kids wearing helmets out there. Pipeline's a wave where it's just so shallow and there's so many injuries. That's really the only wave that you'll see people consistently wearing helmets at.
Yeah, because you're getting, yeah, well, again, then that becomes like a just a part of that, you know, for me, that spot, you know right. what I mean? Like that, or that discipline. And again, just to be clear, I also know a lot of people who I love their video parts, who wear helmets, you know, it's not like I think they're kooky,
right.
You know, I just think
it's just your decision.
It didn't work for me.
Right.
It didn't look good and feel good. It just, yeah, wasn't part of it.
From the aspect of, you know, filming your video parts the way that you wanted them filmed, how early were you looking at these parts from a filmmaking perspective, and when did you realize that you had an interest in film and crafting these scenes from behind the lens?
I think that, as I was talking about before, when I, you know, how much care I took in the creation of the video part and even the things we were just talking about, like how the tiniest decisions can make a difference on, you know, what this, you know, character is in this video, right? In this film, whatever you want to call it. You know, I just zoomed out and was like, wow. So making a video part is filmmaking. It's so similar. Spend a year getting all these shots, collecting them into something that ultimately says something that you're proud of. And sometimes the people who, and you present it in front of an audience and they like it or don't, and it's up to you whether or not you give a shit about that. It's just, it's filmmaking, you know? And I was like, whoa, that's fucking cool. And, you know, it wasn't like dawned on like a light, but it just made me, I think what kind of made me realize that was something I wanted to pursue was looking back to my earlier years and kind of looking back at why I was in Colorado and I was like 25 years old and I kind of was like, what the fuck am I doing here? You know, like, you know, I went on this quest for, in hindsight, yeah, I wasn't this wise probably, but for the self transformation and growth that was just so incredible, you know, and commit everything to something and you become something that becomes somebody you've never met. And it's so beautiful. I just love that so much, you know? But I kind of was at the top of what I feel like that growth was, you know, I'm not saying like I was as good as I could be and I hit all my, I'm not like a goal setter. I just was kind of, you know, that chapter was ending.
Mm.
And I wanted to find another thing that was going to let me grow again. And to, you know, I kind of thought like, oh, like what, there's all these kind of baby steps that make sense, but of what you do after you're pro skier, but they all felt like my glory days were going to be behind me, you know? And I just was like, what if I just went for the big, again, you know, what if I pretending I was a kid on an island again and I wanted to be a pro skier. Like, what is some crazy shit that I could do that I think I would actually have a shot in? And yeah, drawing those parallels of you know, how the process of making the video parts that I did were in some way filmmaking, I decided that maybe that was a good call. And again, looking back at when I was younger on Block Island, I made surf movies when I was growing up, like with my mom's camera, and like me and my buddies had these terrible video parts, you know, but I spent like 2 years making a surf movie, and I like finished it, and like I just made it for me and showed, like, it was me, my buddy Alex, and Tim. We had the three video parts in it, like,
it's,
you know,
best,
we shot this whole intro, yeah, you know, where it came,
yeah,
out of a TV.
It's so fun,
you
man.
Know what I mean? Like that whole thing. And like, you know, I showed it to nobody. It was just for me, you know what I mean? So it's always been a part of me, but I just always, it was always overshadowed by, I was like, I'm an athlete. I'm nothing more than an athlete. So once I recalibrated, I was like, fuck it. I'm going to go all in on this and seek out another like huge transformation. So I just, you know, yeah, started hunting.
One of my close childhood friends and still friends to this day is, his name's Kyle Boothman. He's a really talented filmmaker. He's the one who got me into surfing when I was like 11. And, when he was, I want to say 14, he got an injury where he had stitches and he couldn't surf for a while. So he started filming us, and he made a little surf movie about all of his buddies shredding, and we felt like rock stars because all of a sudden we, right, had someone filming us. Then totally, we want to get, you know, we're like ripping songs off of VHS of like Magnaplasm Vulcan videos.
Yeah, yeah,
and
totally.
Like,
you're making Creepy Fingers too.
Totally. Yeah, you're making, like, Creepy, yeah, Fingers too. You're getting all your best songs. It's like, it's all about the best song that you can use.
Right.
And he today is a legitimate filmmaker. Yeah, it wouldn't have happened because of that injury. But we took so much pride in filming these parts. And he would go to the beach, and there would always be a session, you know, where he'd call four or five of us. We'd go out to the same spot, and for that hour and a half, you surfed as hard as you fucking could to try and get
totally,
a clip.
Man, yeah.
And he'd come in, and you know, maybe he'd get a clip of you.
Be fucking damned if your buddy got the clip and not you, right?
Oh, my, yeah, God. And it was just it was really cool, man. I mean, he ended up making a whole series called the Get Rad series, Get Rad 1, 2, and 3.
Fuck yeah.
And he would rent out the Rio Theater in Santa Cruz.
Oh, shit.
And they would sell out.
No
and
way.
All the Groms all right, would well, come, and we'd be like signing autographs for all the little Groms. And it was just like,
sick.
It was such a cool experience of working hard towards something, compiling footage, making these different edits. And he's a storyteller too, so there'd always be these like skits. Like, I don't know if you ever saw Loose Change when you were a kid,
yeah,
like
totally,
Taylor Steele movie, but like we would all participate in these skits. And then a
fuck
year,
yeah,
later or something, it would be out for the whole town to see. And I think that's so, I think it's so important to just get acquainted with putting that kind of work in, having there be a delay to when the product is finished, and then the product's finished and you're on to the next thing.
Yeah.
And I think that you rob yourself with when it's just instantaneously put out. Like kids these days, they have the benefit of being able to create media and have it come out immediately. But there's also a loss there when it is just being put out into the world like tissue paper and burned, and then you're on to the next thing. You're not compiling something and turning it into a piece of art.
Yeah, you're not trying to make your masterpiece. And, you know, I think a lot of people talk, I think people kind of jump to how like perfectionism is a vice. And like, I don't believe that, you know? I mean, it can get in your way. I'm guilty of it all the time. But, you know, we're lucky to have been forced to do that. Like, you want to make it, you gotta, you know, whether it's in skiing or even just you want to make something cool, like this is how it's done. You spend 2 years or at least a year of your time finding the best shit you can make. And cool part about that, so it's like it's no limit poker, you know, there's no excuses at the end of this. You know, you had all the time that you needed, we had the same amount of time, who did the best shit, you know?
Right.
I loved that. like at the end of the year, all the movies came out, and skiing, at least I'm talking about now, you know, like, and surf movies in that era back in our day. but you know, it's like, who had the best video part? Like, it's
totally,
it's the one with
so
the best
sick.
Video part.
It's so
like
sick.
That's it.
So now, so now you're directing commercials in LA. You took a big swing, moved out here. It's working out for you. Do you also have aspirations in other long form kind of filmmaking?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the first thing I did, I mean, you know, commercials are they're just because I got opportunities and, you know, money's fun. And there's also fun parts of doing it, but I never planned to do that. My initial transition into filmmaking was actually making a documentary about me and my buddies street skiing. And, you know, I just...
What's it called?
For lack of better. It's like this...
And it won a bunch of awards, right?
Yeah, it did. Within skiing, you know, in like the ski space. We won the Powder of Video Awards, which was huge for me for like making my first documentary, you know. But yeah, I just, you know, I was... basically, all the things that we were talking about earlier, I figured people would find interesting. And just, you know, when you're able to zoom out a little bit and realize that like all these people around you, including yourself, are kind of nuts and doing something really weird, you know, it's like, oh, I wonder if I could capture that, you know, make some kind of, at the time I was thinking like some Vice style doc about like these weird dudes, you know, myself included, doing this weird thing, but are like, we were so completely committed to it that I was like, this is interesting, you know? So I, you know, raised a little budget through my sponsors, and I'm close buddies with Todd Jones, the owner of Teton Gravity Research. They're the guys who did the Andy Irons film. Mm. And they, their bread and butter is ski movies, and I was in a lot of their ski movies. And so I pitched the idea to him, and, you know, he's kind of a mentor to me, and picked it up and just thought I had balls for going for it, you know, and probably didn't think anything was going to come of it. And, yeah, then we, you know, won the Powder Video Awards, which was really reassuring for me that I wasn't just crazy and that I could, you know, on some level potentially, you know, have, some talent as a filmmaker. And so the next film I did was, I kind of used that momentum in the ski space. And another half pipe competitor that I used to compete against, who became really, really successful, was this dude, Torin Yeater Wallace. And throughout his success, his dad was in prison for a white collar crime. And like, his family was totally fucked. And he basically became the youngest X Games medalist while his dad was in prison, and his family was all fucked up. And then later on, he like ended up having this crazy rare infection in his liver and almost died, and then won the X Games like a month after it. Like, it's just this wild story that I ended up, you know.
So you directed the story?
Yeah, I convinced him to let me make the story. And then that, I actually pitched ESPN. They picked it up. Then Rebel Media House picked it up. And so then I was able to make a legitimate documentary. And as soon as I got some legs with that, just in like the pre-production stages, I was like, I'm moving to LA.
And what was that one called?
Back to Life. Yep. But, you know, crash course in real filmmaking. I remember telling myself, I'm going to make the world's shittiest actual movie for this. This isn't going to be a ski movie. I'm going to actually try to learn how to write. You know, I'm going to try to learn how to really engage an audience for a long period of time. And you know, like, yeah, go about this not traditionally, but yeah, just, you know, try to make it something that everybody can watch and have empathy for the characters. So,
did you have a background in writing at all?
No, but I just got into it and realized that out of all the filmmaking things that I had a knack for, it was storytelling. So, and I kind of discovered that from the last documentary, you know. Writing documentary is definitely, you know, pretty much as difficult as writing a narrative, I would say, but you're almost, you know, you're kind of writing like prospectively early, and then you're writing, you know, in the edit at the same time. It's a different process, but yeah, throughout that, I, you know.
Is it basically like, I've never written a documentary, but is it basically like, this is how we think it could go, these are the various beats of the story, and then you go and you shoot it and try and get all the interviews to be able to craft that kind of story, and then everything that needs to be filled in to fill in gaps between the interviews with the narration, then you're actually writing the final script there.
Yeah,
is that right?
You got it. You try to hit your beats, your story beats that you think you know, like you've the things you're certain of, but you're never going to really understand your characters until you hear it from them, you know? So it's interesting because it's different from it for every documentary. I mean, you know, you go shoot a documentary, you know, about a war somewhere, and you might just go hunting. You know, you have no idea what you're going to find, but you just know something crazy's happening right now, right? And yeah. then you don't even know who your lead is. You can go try to find a lead. I've never done anything like that, but... you know, for the film that I did, a lot of it was in the past. It probably would have been better suited as a narrative film, to be honest. But yeah, basically, you know, you gather your talking head interviews and you are like, all right, here's the found footage we have that can, you know, cover these stages of the story. And, you know, for this, we need to either do recreations, or you can animate, or you could, you know, whatever. But you just have to find a way to piece together the storyline.
So fascinating, man. You live your life with such immediacy. It's really cool. It feels like you don't wait in a way that has allowed you to do a lot at a relatively young age and just send it, whether it's on a jump or into the documentary world. It's really cool to hear the story.
Oh, thank you, man. Yeah, I'm hoping to keep acting that way, I guess, you know, keep putting it all down on black. Yeah, these days I'm trying to dive into narrative. I have a script that's optioned right now, and we just casted somebody who, because this whole strike thing and whatever, I can't talk about honestly, but whatever. I'm still on my over the top at all costs, go for it mentality, you know, just trying to go 100% all the time. So I appreciate the praise there, but that is mostly because it's coming from you, from someone who surfs Mavericks. I will always take a compliment.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've lived pretty parallel lives in both athletics and now, you know, living in Los Angeles, getting more into the media world. It's just kind of funny. When I met you, I was like, huh, I feel like this guy's kind of just been on a very similar track as I have.
I love it, man. Yeah, it's absolutely similar. And, you know, it's always fun that there's to think back that there's just, you know, there's somebody on the other side of the world or somewhere in, you know, right next to you. It doesn't matter. There's always somebody who's, got a similar brain and has similar goals or aspirations, you know. It's always fun when the universe brings you together.
Absolutely. So where can people find you if they want to reach out? Instagram,
depends what in what capacity. Yeah, I got an Instagram. It's my name, Clayton Villa.
Okay, we'll link
Clayton
to it.
Villa.
Hello.
Villa. Either way. Filmmaking. I have a website, samename.com. Yeah, I don't know. Give it a Google. It depends what capacity you're trying to reach out in, whether it's filmmaking or skiing or whatever, but you'll find me.
Highly, highly recommend smoking a blunt and typing this dude's name into YouTube. You will come across some wild videos of people skiing stuff that you never thought possible.
I don't have to tell the audience that about you. They already know.
All right, buddy. Thank you so much. What a blast.
Thank you, man.
That's our show. Before you head off into your day, you can go to tierman.substack.com to get my newsletter, my articles, thoughts, ramblings. If you want to hear more from me, tierman.substack.com is the place to be. That's it for now. Thank you so much for tuning in. Get out in the water, whatever body of water is closest to you, lake, river, bathtub, or ocean. I promise it will make your day better. See you soon.